recording? Okay. Happy Epiphany, though this is Epiphany 2. Welcome back. I should make an introductory statement. We're starting something new that goes beyond this room. This is the first time, and it may be an experimental first draft of recording these sessions and putting them out on our website onto the internet. So theoretically, if this all works, what we are saying today could be heard by alumni of the people who have gone before you and perhaps even sat in this room with us years ago who might be wanting to work through these texts with us as they're sitting out in the front lines on the congregations and the pastors' studies of our churches working through the same texts in preparation for sermons. To you that may be listening out there, welcome. And I want to explain our procedure. By the way, we've been doing this. Maybe you here in the room don't even know that. We've been doing this for years and years and years. This all started back actually when I was a student here in the 70s. And a couple of us students got Dr. Hummel together, and we sat down and started reading through the lessons every week. And it's kind of just kept on going over these years. And what we are doing now is working, just so the people out in the parishes know this, we are working a week and a half in advance. So this is obviously the week of Epiphany 1, but we are working on the texts for Epiphany 2, so that we have that much lead time for working on the text. And we simply read through the Greek and the Hebrew of the texts and make some exegetical comments, but it's focused, first of all, on translational issues. So our text today is Isaiah 62, 1 to 5, one of those great, great, great Isaiah texts. This is of some personal interest because this was actually my wedding text that we used when my wife and I were married. And it's, in my opinion, the Old Testament counterpart to the Ephesians 5 section, but with a reverse twist. In Ephesians 5, Paul is using the relationship of marriage as an analogy for, no, how does it go? As, no, he's using the relationship of Christ and the church as a model for marriage. Right? As Christ loved the church, so husbands love your wives and give yourselves up for her. Here in Isaiah, Isaiah is using the model of marriage as the model of God and his bride, people. So it's the same relationship, but he's just going at it from the other way. Now you got to connect this to the whole of Isaiah here and realize that the people have been suffering, have been silent. And let's get right into the text and pick up on that theme. Though 62, you really have to run at least back to 60, which is the Epiphany text itself. Arise, shine, for your light has come. And the two motifs here, one of the light, and the light is actually, remember, the light of God's people, your light. But that light, of course, has as its real source God himself. So we sort of have this, imputed light or righteousness given to God's people. But in fact, it is connected to them, you see. How do unbelievers see God's light in the world except through the people of God, you see, as they reflect that light? And then the second great Epiphany theme, that this is a light for the Gentiles, even us. Remember, we the Gentiles here, we're the outsiders. It's interesting in sort of contemporary world that this whole business of the Jew first and then the Greek has kind of been reversed. If you would say, is Christianity essentially a Gentile religion or a Jewish religion, most people today would identify Christianity with Gentiles. And in fact, that's secondary to its identification with the Jewish people, you see. And those involved in Jewish evangelism are always kind of fighting this problem out there where people where from a Jewish background immediately think that this is not for them. When we should be thinking, gee, it really isn't for us, but it is, you see. It's the extra grace that we're included in the people of God as well. So we're kind of in this whole thing about the people of God now receiving light and being a light to the nations. Okay, Lama'an Sion, lo echsha, for the sake of Zion, not I will kasha. Be quiet. This is kind of to take a little breather. All right, not to sit down and take a nap as much as just to take a little breather. The second word for rest is a little stronger, and Lama'an Yerushalayim, and for the sake of Jerusalem, lo eshkot, I will not be at peace, at rest. Shekat, I think this is the word that's used in like Judges for the land had rest. It's one of those rest words for be at peace, you see. Now it's interesting that God, who is speaking here, this is in the first person of Yahweh, God himself is speaking, and he can't rest. I mean, you got this image of someone who just can't sit still until he's got the thing, the problem solved. You probably feel that way once in a while yourself, or you can identify with that feeling. So I will not keep silent until what? Line two. Ad yetze ka noga. Boy, the light is dim. Tzidka, until... What's the subject? Yetza has the subject tzidka. Her tzedek, her righteousness, will go forth ka noga, like brightness, like a bright light. And parallel to that, Yeshuatha, her Yeshua, her salvation, ka lapid, like a lamp, lapid is lamp, yivar, will burn. Okay, will burn. Now, lamps didn't, we think of a halogen a headlight or something like that. These lamps burning aren't very bright. They're oil lamps. But hey, when it's dark, a little candle on the water, or a flame in the wind, or what's the Princess Di song? Candle in, something like that. Candle in the wind, that was it. Yeah, right. Again, note that the parallel between Tzedek and Yeshua is significant. Huh? Righteousness and salvation are really parallel concepts, and they're identified with her. Who's the antecedent of her? See, it doesn't really say God's righteousness. It's already been connected to Zion and Yerushalayim, Zion and Jerusalem. They now possess God's righteousness. Second theme of Epiphany, verse 2, Vara'u Goyim, and the Goyim will see, while consecutive, will see your tzedek. See, it's your tzedek. This is very mission evangelistic oriented. Would that people would see, just in the everyday life of God's people, something different. You know, it doesn't have to be that you can't stop praying or talking about or saying Jesus loves me in every sin. It doesn't necessarily have to be that you're handing out tracts in every street corner. But something in your life should be observably different, I would think, in reflecting the light of Christ, just the way you conduct your business, your way of life. Until the goyim will see your tzedek, and all kings... provide the verb again, we'll see your kavod, your glory. Now, if you just want to, you know, drive yourself crazy with theological substance, track kavod through the book of Isaiah, all right? This great theme of God's glory, and the translation glory hardly does justice to kavod. But now it's yours, you see. This is moving, fast forwarding through about 10 paragraphs of theological exegetical unpacking. But if kavod is in the end God's localized real presence here on earth, i.e. sacramental presence connected to God and given to God's people, in the same way God's glory in Christ's body and blood becomes part of us. That's part of the eating and drinking, you see, that it's actually part of us. And is sort of organically linked to our body and blood. 2b. And karalach shame kadash. And one will call. This is the impersonal sense of giving somebody a name. Somebody will cry out to you. That's a way of giving you a name. This is somebody sees you on the street, they're going to cry out to you, your name. A shame kadash, a new name, Now remember, names are terribly significant, getting a new name, and we'll see why the new name is even more significant here in this passage. We did Isaiah 9 right before Christmas, and the name of the Messianic child will be Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father. And if you preached on the end of this chapter on Christmas, one of the Christmas texts is the end of this chapter, Isaiah 62, 10 to 12, where the people get a new name. And this is connected to that, aren't you? This is the beginning of the same chapter, okay? And it's kind of, I think I made that comment before Christmas, it's kind of neat. You can talk about when a baby is born, everybody's worried about what's the baby's name going to be. When Jesus is born, yeah, we can talk about his name, but guess what? We get a new name, see? What's the name of his people going to be, all right? We get a new name, which, where does this name come from? Which be Yahweh Yikavanu. Here's a verb you probably don't recognize. You want to take a stab at that form at the end? Ooh, tricky form here. It's actually a first nun. You see the assimilated nun? From Nakav, which means to designate, specify, something like that. So one will call to you a new name which the mouth of Yahweh will designate. He will give. The story comes to mind of John the Baptist when they asked Zechariah, okay, I mean, this was the role of the father now, sort of publicly to say, what are you going to call this kid? All right, his name will be John. Three, and you will be Hayith, oh, that's a great form, Kal, perfect, wow, consecutive, second singular feminine. You never really thought you'd ever see this form. Second singular feminine with just the tau ending, and you will be a eteret tipereth, a crown of beauty. These are loaded words in Isaiah. In Isaiah 3, he takes away all the beauty of the women. He lists 21, 7 times 3, 21 items there in Isaiah chapter 3 that he's going to take away from them, clean out their closets, their jewelry chests, everything, gone. All the beauty that's identified with a woman was gone. Now you're going to get it all back. See, the woman being the sort of corporate Zion, the bride of Christ. You will be a crown of beauty in the Yad Yahweh, in the hand of Yahweh. And at Sinof, this is the word for diadem. Ask your kids what a diadem is. I'm sure they won't know. This is another kind of a headband, a royal head. Well, it's modified by miluka. A diadem of royalty, if you will, of kingdom, a royal diadem in the kaf Elohaic, in the hand, the palm of your God. Four, not Yeamer lak od, lo Yeamer lak od azuva. Interesting, he switches to a 3-2 meter here, a kind of a kina meter, which is usually a dirge mourning meter. And he's throwing it in the face of a dirge because this is good stuff. But it's really a response to a dirge because they were called Azuva and Shimama in chapter 6. The whole point of chapter 6 is to tell the people that they're going to get beaten down until there's nothing left. And even if there's a tenth remained, it will be for burning until your land is Azuva, forsaken, and your cities are a shimama, a desolation. And now he takes those same two words and says, no longer applies. Okay? And not will be said to you, oath, again, azuva, forsaken. And to your land, lo, yeat mer, it will not be said, oath, again, shimama, a desolation. Ki lak yikare, because to you it will be called heftziva. Now you'll find this transliterated as Keftziva, all right, which is the name. In fact, it's the name of one of the queens at the time of Isaiah. Keftziva was the queen, wife of King Hezekiah, and the mother of all people, the least likely messianic child, Manasseh, who was one of the worst kings ever. Okay. And whether there is some sort of historical connection in the back of Isaiah's mind here is a very intriguing question. But we will have to leave that for another day. For to you it will be called, now if you translate, instead of transliterate Keftziva, Katsev, Ketzav is the word for desire, a delight, a very happy word. It's the same word you get, by the way, at the end of Isaiah 53 when it's the delight of Yahweh to crush the suffering servant, a sort of strange way of talking about God's delight, unless you understand the theological implications of what the suffering servant was really supposed to do to bring joy to Yahweh by dying for the sins of the world. So you've got that connection here. Here it's got a very positive connotation. My delight is in her. And to your land, Beulah, transliterated Beulah, which is the kal passive participle of the verb Baal, to be lord, master, husband, responsible person who takes care of his bride, or to marry. All right. Remember that in ancient world, to be unmarried, either an old maid, as we might call one, or a widow, and with that, to have no children, even married, but to be barren, were two of the worst things that could happen to a woman. Like it or not, this doesn't ring well in contemporary world, but to be without a husband meant you didn't have any social standing, any right, any income, no breadwinner, you had nothing, see. And here this whole image of the bride of God is connected to that social motif that unless you have a husband, you got nothing. Unless you're connected to your bridegroom, God, you got nothing. But you are connected and you got everything. That's the point. To you it will be called, my delight is in her, and to your land, married. For Yahweh has delighted in you, and your land will be married. Five, starts with key, which is not the number, but the word, four. As a bridegroom, that's the word for bride, or a young man. Bachur is really a young man, kind of a stud. Baal will marry a bitulah. Bitulah is really the word for virgin. As a young man marries a virgin, so your... Now, banayak is really the word for sons. Your sons, Baaluk, will marry you. All right, a lot of ink's been spilled on what this means, that your sons will marry you. This is a little clumsy. You could amend the text to your builders. There's this problem between son and builder. They're the same word in Hebrew. After all, how do you build a house but by having sons? It doesn't have to do with buildings. It has to do with people. That's the biblical concept of family and household. So your sons will marry you. I think if the you here is the land, what this is talking about is your sons will again claim the land as their own and provide for it the sense of identity, continuity, and stability in the future, looking beyond the exile now to the return of the descendants of Zion to Jerusalem. And finally, 5b, this is the word for bridegroom, katan, as the rejoicing of, that's the joy of, a bridegroom over upon his bride, a bride, so your God, so will rejoice over you, your God. Okay? So your God will rejoice over you, taking the role of the bridegroom here and the joy that comes with marriage and a lovely, well-adorned, beautiful bride. See? Well, if you can't do something with all this, we better go on, Jeff. Here we got to move on to the New Testament. But any quick questions? It's just a beautiful, rich text on this whole relationship between God and his people. But again, historically, put this in the context of a people who thought they had no hope. Already in the 8th century, you don't have to wait till the Babylonian captivity for the people of Israel to be without hope. When they were living under Manasseh, they didn't see much light at the end of the tunnel. But ultimately, this plays out, of course, in the Babylonian period, the return from Babylon, but even then, it's still not the way we thought it ought to be yet, because it wasn't done yet. It's still not done yet, is it? Okay, Jeff.